Welcome back to Russian Roulette, the podcast for the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm your host, Olga Oliker, here in the CSIO studio with my co-host, Jeff Mankoff.
Hello there.
So today we have a really interesting conversation with Leonid Nersisyan.
Or you do, at least.
I do, yeah. Well, we have it for the audience. Leonid is a military analyst with the Regnum Information Agency, and he's also editor-in-chief of the New Defense Order Strategy magazine. Leonid and I talked about the state of Russian military analysis in Russia, media and think tank landscape, what it's like to run a military journal, what people aren't paying enough attention to in regards to the Russian armed forces, new military technologies, the Russian military industrial complex, all the good things. And then after that, for one of our current affairs segments, Jeff and I are going to talk a little bit about what's been going on in Armenia. So welcome, Leonid. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So I thought we would begin by talking a little bit. You edit a journal called The New Defense Order Strategy. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and what sorts of articles appear in it?
This magazine is about Russian military industry complex mostly, and about arms market. And we have a really big lack of analytical centers, think tanks in Russia, and we are trying to take this space by doing a good magazine. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to write nice articles which are don't have propaganda inside of them. Mm-hmm. So it's some objective and factual information. Mm-hmm. So. Of course, not everybody is reading this kind of magazines because it's specialized, but it's becoming pretty popular because we are working with the best authors in Russia, and we are not working with guys who are just mm-hmm. speaking about propaganda things like, I don't know, Russian army mm-hmm. is the most strongest and everything is better than American. All these things are 90% of Russian media is writing things like that. So we're trying to be on the other side.
So who are your readers?
Look, our magazine is for free. You can have it on all military events like military shows, military conferences. So you can see the PDF on the internet. Mm-hmm. Mostly it's people who work in military industry or are interested in military things. So one print run is 10,000 of copies most of time, and all the magazines are realized, and so everybody likes it because you won't find a magazine in Russia which is better made. Mm-hmm. And it's very nice graphics and it's very nice articles. We work with Center of Analysis, Strategies mm-hmm. and Technologies. Many authors from there uh-huh. Work with us. So even in defense ministry, people are reading it. And
can I ask who funds it?
Oh, the military industry complex mostly funds it because they are not giving money just for magazine. They are buying some commercial
advertising
things inside it. So most of articles are neutral and just analytical, mm-hmm. but there are some articles which are mm-hmm. Just bought by...
And you publish in Russian and in English.
We have 2 issues in English this year and 3 issues in Russian. So
it's not the same that one issue is just translated it?
No, it's not the same because English issues, you can see them in Europe, in India, mm-hmm. in South America mm-hmm. on big okay. events.
And who, so you said some of the folks who work for CAST write for the journal. Who are the civilian experts on the Russian military and Russian military industry these days? Where do they come from? Do they come from universities? Do they come from journalism?
It's an interesting question because Military analytics, not military journalism. It's not very many of real military experts you can find who are not working in Ministry of Defense, maybe, or somewhere else. Most of them earn money by writing some articles for media, because there is no other way to earn something, because there are very few think tanks in Russia. They are very small. They are they don't have big finances. So this is like only think tank which is doing nice military analysis is CAST, which we already mentioned, and it's pretty small, and you can't compare it with American think tanks, which you have, I don't know, I think more than 2,000 of them, I guess.
There are a lot of think tanks.
So,
but Russia, some of them are smaller and more effective and less effective. Some of them are bigger and more effective. Some of them are smaller and more effective. There's a wide range.
So the most of Russian military information is some articles in media, and many of them lack professional view and have too much mistakes or propaganda or something like this.
So what are some of the issues that you think don't get enough attention in the Russian military development space?
It's hard to answer this question. Of course, people like reading things about tanks, about nuclear weapons, about something big and strong. But there are many other things in army which are not so popular for civilian people who are just interested in military. I don't know, some engineering forces, some other things.
So what should we be interested in about the engineering forces?
I don't know, some repair vehicles which are made, which lack in army sometimes, and medical and evacuation vehicles. They are pretty old and need replacement. There are some processes going on this, but they are not going fast, and Russia need to make more on this topic.
What is your assessment overall of the progress of reforms and the success of reforms? You mentioned this; these are some areas where perhaps it hasn't moved as quickly. What's your overall assessment of the state of the Russian armed forces?
I think quality became much better these times. You can see it everywhere. It's not difficult to see that. But still, there are many questions. And still, Russian Navy is getting worse and worse because new ships are not built. They are trying to build them, but they don't have propulsion systems for new ships, because only Ukraine made them, and now there is no trade between these countries. But maybe time will solve these problems, maybe not, because Navy is not getting much money from government, and not only money is the problem. You can give money to just to somebody, but he won't make something good from it.
Right, you can't always be certain.
Complex of, I don't know, these factories and manufacturers is in very low state now. So they are making repairs of one ship for 10 years, I don't sometimes. This is a big problem, and I don't see it changing this time.
So you see the investment continues to be mostly in the ground forces, and then to some extent to the air force. That
We had seen a pretty big investment in Navy in last armament program, but it was not effective. It was two times more than land forces investment last time, but they couldn't use this money well. So we don't see the progress, really. We see only progress with submarines, but we don't see progress with
surface ships.
Yes. And now they give much less money for new armaments program. And Navy will have two times less money, and now land forces will have a big money, because, as I understand, they want to build new tanks and new armored vehicles for these new projects, T-14 Armata, Kurganets 25, and other new projects.
And what is your sense of how the ground forces feel about these new technologies? Are they excited about them? Do they not expect to see anything that soon? Do they expect that it will only go to a few units anyway, so it doesn't matter?
A Ministry of Defense is saying that there are plans to buy 2,000 Armata tanks, but I think it's too early to speak about that kind of numbers, because now the first bunch of tanks is going to test into the army, and we will see. Will they want to buy more, or how many more they will buy? Still, Armata is much cheaper than any tank made in Western countries. It's much more expensive than T-90 or T-72, but it's still cheaper than Western one.
Right, but the Russian defense budget is also smaller than, say, the American defense
budget.
Yes,
of course, it works this way. But if you really want to buy a new tank, you can buy, 500 of them. It's not solving global problems, but Russia is not doing big wars now, and no country is doing big wars. If you need to solve something in Syria or somewhere else, it's having 100 or 200 new tanks is enough for.
So that's an interesting question that you raise, whether Russia is investing in the right forces for the wars it's fighting. What's the mix? If you look at how Russia exercises, it exercises for very big wars. If you look at the wars it fights pretty small wars. Is it buying weapons for big wars or small wars, or is it trying to do both at once?
I think Russia is trying to do both, because if you have so big country, so big army, you need to do exercises for both, for little local conflicts, for a big war. Of course, there are not no big chances that we will see a World War III or something like this, or even a big regional conflict.
Or if we see World War III, it won't last long enough to use up all those Armada tanks.
We don't know how it will look. Maybe they will just start with conventional. Then, when one of sides will see that it's losing, it will start using nukes, and everything will go.
That's certainly a plausible hypothesis for World War III. Yeah.
I don't think that it will happen, but maybe some big regional conflict. I don't know. You will never know what will happen in 5 or 10 years now. Things are changing very fast. Like, imagine a war of Russia with Turkey. I don't know. It's a pretty big war, but it's not nuclear and it's conventional.
Where would it be fought, this war between Russia and Turkey?
In South Caucasus, maybe. In Syria.
In Syria, there's a bit of a conflict between
the people. We had seen already once. The war was really close when the Su-24 was
shut down.
Yeah. So you will never know what will happen. So Russia is a kind of country which must have a capable army to fight with big countries too. Like USA, I think, is doing training also for big wars and for small wars.
All the things, all the time, with all the money.
Of course.
That does raise the question. So if you look at Russian operations in Syria, what do they tell you about Russian forces, Russian investment, how Russia's armed forces are likely to evolve? What weapons will they be buying based on what you've seen in Syria?
We have seen many new weapons used in Syria by Russian forces. It's new cruise missiles, the air-based cruise missiles. They were pretty effective. Of course, Syria is not a real enemy for using them, but still they were used nicely. But Russia is not producing very many of them. You can't compare the producement of Tomahawk missiles in USA or calibers in Russia. Also, Russia have not many carriers for calibers if we compare it to USA. I don't know. In Russia, maybe you will count maybe 100 of them. I don't think that much more. But still, it's interesting for doing some precision strikes. And we saw it.
Russia saw precision strike weapons, right? I'm not sure we saw much in the way of actual precision strikes where you might have needed one, right?
We saw new corrected bombs, precision bombs. We saw some smaller air launch rockets, which are much more precision than before. Of course, mostly Russia is using just traditional bombs without guidance systems. But still, sometimes they use the new ones, and they showed them not bad. But the producement of them, of these new weapons, is pretty at low rate, so Russia just don't have too many of these bombs to use only them.
Do you expect it to produce more, or do you expect this mix to continue?
In new armament program, the new precision weapons, they got big financing. So I think that we will see more of them in army, because the older Soviet weapons are getting older. It's no use to buy a Su-30 SM fighter if you don't have good air-to-air rockets or something like this. Then you just have the same plane like before.
Do you see an evolution in Russian procurement over the last few years? Are there changes in how the defense ministry deals with the defense industry? Have they gotten better at getting more quality for money?
Yes, if you will compare it with 90s or beginning of 2000s, the effectiveness is much more, and there are much more control now. It's pretty difficult to steal money now if you are working in military industry.
You think corruption is under control?
You can never say that there is no corruption, but when they have, I don't know, you must build 50 new fighters, you must build them. It's not working other way now. Maybe you will need some more time for that, but now they are building, really building them. And before they were just getting money and were just sitting, and after 5 years you couldn't see anything.
So what did the Russian government do to get better results?
More control mechanisms. So they give you money and they are not giving you the whole money from beginning. You get, I don't know, 1 million from 10. You do some work. Then you show this work, and then they give you the next 1 million. Mm-hmm. It works something like this now.
And how competitive is defense procurement in Russia now? Is the contract signed usually with a single firm, and then that firm produces for most weapons? I mean, obviously it depends on the weapons, but actually it would be interesting to talk about how this works differently for different systems. Whether there's a tender that goes out and lots of firms can apply, or whether there's a deal made with a single firm or just one or two firms that can compete.
It's not working this way in Russia, like in USA, when you have, I don't know, Lockheed Martin and Boeing fighting for this F-35 project, who will build this fighter. No, it's not working like that. It worked when USSR was alive. Mm-hmm. It worked that way, like MiG and Sukhoi, and there were much more stronger manufacturers that time. Now Russia is more competitive with some other countries, so they are making a new weapon to sell it somewhere, and they are looking that, I don't know, USA have F-15, and we need to make a plane which is cheaper and have the same characteristics. So it works like this. If we took this strategic weapons, which you can't sell, there are not many manufacturers for that. So most of them are, these guys are doing liquid fueled rockets. These guys are doing solid fuel. So it looks like this.
Who's building the new weapons that Vladimir Putin announced on March 1st? Which firms have those contracts?
Oh, like if you took this glider vehicle, it's NPO Mashinostroyenie.
Okay, so that's an old that's an old venerable company that's been around a long time.
Yes, they have most of hypersonic technologies in Russia, because they started that in USSR. All this glider technology, it's not new. USSR had the Albatross project, which was actually the same avant-garde. But still, there were no such technologies to do a serial producement in USSR. Mm-hmm. Then we had 90s, where there were no military budget at all, practically. So now they are starting to finish Soviet projects.
So what other firms are doing some of these other programs?
Spoken about this underwater torpedo, there is no actual information about it. It's really difficult to say. What about other weapons? If we took the Iskander, it's a corporation, Taktическое ракетное вооружение. It means tactical
rocket weaponry.
Yes. Most of rockets, tactical rockets, are made by this company. Also, the new hypersonic missile will be made by this, cruise missile will be made by this company.
So it's still a small number of companies that have most of the contracts.
And this Sarmat missile is made by Makeyev's.
Yes.
There are not many companies, so.
Right. So we've had some excitement in the South Caucasus recently with an Armenian government that voluntarily stepped down in the face of protests, which raises the question of whether Russia will become militarily involved in its neighborhood as time goes on. If there's unrest in Armenia, if there's unrest somewhere else, and whether it has the right forces for that, for peacekeeping operations. What do you see in that realm?
You mean defending the regime in Armenia or what? I don't
understand. I think whatever.
Or fighting with Azerbaijan and Turkey. What do you mean by this question?
I was thinking more peacekeeping missions in case of domestic unrest, but I suppose all things are possible.
So we see that this protest made the prime minister to reject, and yeah. I don't think that in Russia everybody was...
No, everybody was very calm about it in Russia.
Yes, because... I don't think that they really liked Serge Sargsyan in Russia, too. He's just this kind of politics who nobody likes.
But I'm just thinking in terms, in the 1990s, most of Russia's military interventions abroad were in its neighborhood and were peacekeeping missions, broadly defined. I am wondering if we expect, and if the Russians expect, to see a resurgence of that again.
Russian forces in Armenia are keeping Turkey from involving in the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. Mm-hmm. This is their main mission because, of course, Russia don't want Turkey to be involved in anything in South Caucasus because Russia want to dominate in this region, and this is why these forces are there. And they are not very big. It's 5,000 people personnel. It's like 80 tanks, 18 fighters, MiG-29. So it's not enough for fighting with Turkey or Armenia or Azerbaijan. It's just Russia is here.
It's a presence.
If you will attack
it's a tripwire.
Armenian border from Turkey, Russia will just start doing some... airstrikes and will bring more army there.
So what do you think are the technologies to be watching in the future? What are some of the directions you think the Russian military may go technologically, which will be interesting to watch?
Oh, it's an interesting question, but in Russia, many projects are top secret things. And
so there's no knowing?
It's difficult to know about them forward. The interesting things may be making small cruise missiles like Ha-50, which is now in development. You can use it with Su-34 frontline bomber. You can use it with Tu-22, so you will get more carriers for these weapons, and it will be cheaper than big Ha-101 missile, and this will solve some of these problems we talked before, that Russia don't have much carriers for cruise missiles, and this will solve a problem with INF treaty, because this is why Russia maybe just really wants to make some ground-launched cruise missiles, because it don't have sea-based like USA.
But it does.
It does, but very few. There are very few if you will compare with...
Well, it could always build more sea-based missiles.
You can't build enough ships because your manufacturers are doing bad work.
So this is your explanation for the INF violation, is that it's too hard to build this?
Not only explanation. Also, other countries are building intermediate-range missiles.
Sure, well, that's been the case for a long time. I mean, that's the argument against the treaty, both in the United States and in Russia.
And we see...
But generally, countries don't just violate the treaty in response to that.
You can't say that Russia really violated it at this moment, because if we are talking about RS-26 missiles, it's closed. It's not going to be in army anymore until 2027, I think. It's not no tests are conducted already for 3 years, I guess, yes. And if we are talking about this cruise missile, intermediate range, we don't have much information about it. I think they are ready to produce something like they are ready to produce it in big numbers if there will be a, if we meet need of that.
So why do you think the Russians went this far with production of a system that wasn't treaty compliant? Do you think it was just defense industry getting ahead of itself? Do you think they thought that the Americans wouldn't notice? What explains taking those additional steps that made it treaty non-compliant?
I think they just completed the scientific works and because they are not very hard, because you have the Kalibr missile, you have the Ha-101 missile, and it's not very hard to adapt it for the land-based launcher. They just made this work, and I don't think that they will produce real missiles in big quantity.
But the United States have said that they're deployed, so...
United States says that they are deployed, but we don't have the fact information. Maybe one regiment is deployed. Maybe it's not deployed. It's difficult to judge on that because we haven't seen them. Maybe. Because we can see this MK-41s in Romania and in Poland also. If you read the treaty, it's really written there that there should not be any launchers which are capable of carrying...
Right. Well, and I think there's a way to resolve the MK-41 problem, and I think the United States has offered to do that.
But you know that MK-41 is capable of carrying Tomahawk. You can put a Tomahawk there anytime.
Right. So, fine. So, if you had asked me what the explanation is for the U.S. deployment of the MK-41, which is potentially treaty non-compliant, the answer would be it never occurred to anybody that it was treaty non-compliant because it wasn't intended for that purpose. So it was just an oversight. And I think now the United States would be willing to take steps to make it clear that that's not what it's doing. So kind of the same question for Russia is what happened to get to that place?
Maybe it made nervous some people in defense ministry in Russia that US have plans to deploy MK-41s. Maybe,
though the Russians didn't complain about the MK-41s until after the United States brought up the Russian violation.
So it's really difficult to know what is in the people's heads. So,
okay.
I think USA won't need a long time to develop land-based cruise missiles either.
No, it's
US
not.
Had the land-based Tomahawk missile before. You can just make some
right,
of them.
But the United States is very legalistic, so they won't. They will continue to be in line with the treaty, right, up until...
They say that they will develop but won't build them, yes. But when USA will need it, it will just say, I'm getting out of INF treaty.
Right, which Russia could also do.
Russia have less political and military and other weight in world. So when Russia is doing such things, everybody starts... attacking it, that you are violating this, you are violating that. So it will be hard to explain why Russia is getting out of INF treaty. USA just can't get out and say, we want to do that that way. And nobody will complain from NATO, from other... Only China and Russia will complain about that,
so it's
to be fair.
It's better to violate the treaty and get accused of violating it than to pull out of the treaty?
We still don't know if it's really how it's violated, what level it's violated or it's not violated. I don't know. If Russia really wanted to violate it, why it's not building this RS-26 missiles?
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe it's a way to show that we need a discussion about that. We need a discussion about BMD. We need a discussion about INF treaty. You are not listening to us. We will make a... This is how maybe the way they are thinking.
So you think that the Russian government is interested in further arms control?
I think it's also difficult to say how people are thinking there, but I hope that they are thinking this way because I don't think that arms race is the thing that world needs now.
Great. Leonid, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you too for nice talk.
All right, that was a interesting discussion. You know, one of the things that came up in there was Armenia, which is going through a pretty unprecedented period of political turmoil now. So we thought it might be a good idea for our current events segment to talk a little bit about what's going on in Armenia.
So an interesting question to ask is, you know, how unprecedented is this? Armenia has had political protests that were successful before. Armenia has had changes of government.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how closely our listeners follow political developments in Armenia, but one of the things that's interesting about it is that it has had a relatively pluralistic political system for its history as an independent post-Soviet country. And there have been elections and changes of power, even though it's sort of a semi-autocracy.
And in fact, I mean, this is what brought on this last wave of protests is that the guy who'd been president of Armenia since 2008,
Serge Sargsyan,
had been planning to become prime minister, and in fact, very briefly did become prime minister.
Right. So it's interesting that the government is controlled by Sargsyan's party, or has been up until now controlled by Sargsyan's party, decided to allow him to step down and become prime minister rather than, say, finagle a way to allow him to become president again. But at the same time, right, they did switch the constitution to make the prime minister the more sort of powerful position, which is what triggered the outbreak of these protests.
Right. I mean, it was sort of a Putin 2008 scenario almost, right? Yeah. The idea that I want to stay in power, but I don't want to mess with the Constitution too much. I don't want I want to try to do this subtly.
But they did mess with the Constitution.
Yeah. It's an interesting phenomenon. And the other thing that's interesting about it, right, they vote him prime minister on April 17th. The protests actually started a little bit before that. People knew this was going to happen.
In the works. And I mean, the other thing that's interesting is how the protest played out from the beginning, because the leader of the protests, Nikol Pashinyan, is a member of parliament from another party, but from a very small party. He hasn't been, up until now, one of the major opposition figures, but he's been really successful at galvanizing people to come out in the street, not only in opposition to the constitutional changes and to Sargsyan remaining in power, but has really been pushing to have himself appointed prime minister instead.
And it looks like he's about to be successful. By the time this posts, he may be he may be prime minister.
Yeah. Although there's still plenty of political intrigue ahead. You know, he's managed to get some of the political parties that had been in Sargsyan's coalition to effectively defect and support him. But at the same time, Sargsyan's own party, the Republicans, have hedged their bets a little bit, and it's unclear whether they're going to support him.
Well, it looks, as of today, as we're recording this on May 3rd, it looks like they agreed to, right? On May 1st, they said they wouldn't. On May 2nd, there were more protests.
Yeah, they said they would support anybody who got a third of the parliament behind them. So it's seems likely, but
which looks like Pashinyan. I mean, who else is going to? Or you have
or
nobody.
Nobody does, I think, is the question, right? There's not an alternative, but there's the possibility that there could be more political maneuvering, that you could have an interim government, that you could have, you know, really prolonged political uncertainty.
Right. Well, and he is going to have to create a government as prime minister.
Yeah.
And then there's the question of
who's in it?
Who's in it? Do they maintain the system with a very strong prime minister going forward, which is an accident of Sargsyan's trying to stay in power? Is that then still going to be the way this country is governed?
Yeah. And, you know, because Pashinyan's party is not particularly large, he has this big protest movement of people in the street, but he doesn't have kind of the political infrastructure backing him. There's going to have to be some kind of negotiations and coalition with other political forces. And what are the trade-offs that these different forces are going to demand?
I mean, the other interesting thing, which is something that Leonid and I discussed a little bit, is that Russia has been very hands-off through all of this, which is smart, I would argue, from Moscow's standpoint. But Moscow isn't always smart when these things happen. And it's worth noting, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that there's absolutely no way to point to any kind of Western meddling here.
Which doesn't mean that that's not something Russian commentators have been talking about. I mean, I think there is a strand of analysis in Russia, in the press, and probably in the government too, that sees this as being kind of a rerun of the Orange Revolution or the Euromaidan as part of this Western-inspired scheme of regime change. That said, you know, there's not a political figure in Armenia who's calling for membership in NATO. So there's not clearly this divide between sort of pro-Russian and pro-Western political forces.
There's absolutely no reason to think that any government that takes form in Armenia over the next days, weeks, months, however long it takes, is not going to be pro-Russian.
Well, is not going to be at least
beholden
realistic about the realities of Armenia's situation, which includes Russia's military and security presence, its large role in the economy, and the extent to which Armenia is dependent for its security on Russia.
Right. Well, in the same way that no imaginable Armenian government's going to say, hey, never mind about Nagorno-Karabakh, Azerbaijan, you can have that back.
Yeah, well, and that's an interesting question, too, is how does Nagorno-Karabakh play into all of this? You know, whatever Pashinyan stands for, he doesn't seem to be any more dovish on Nagorno-Karabakh than the current government, if anything, is probably a little bit more hardline on it.
He hasn't said much on the topic. I mean,
In terms of his record over the course of his time in parliament and before that as a journalist. But more than that, right, is what does Azerbaijan do in the midst of all of this political uncertainty in Armenia?
Right. And if you follow the Azeri press, they're a little bit nervous.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of people in Armenia who are nervous, too, that Azerbaijan may decide to, you know, take advantage of the turmoil to do something.
It is potentially exciting.
Well, this part of the world is often exciting, for better or worse.
But this one, we really didn't call this one. It's amazing. A few weeks ago, we actually had an event on Armenia on the eve of Sarkisian's becoming prime minister. And
the video of which is available on our website.
Yeah, no, we have a link in the show notes. You can watch it. And it was a great event and a terrific conversation. But no, you know, everyone predicted the status quo would. People would suck it up and accept
that there's no alternative.
That there's no alternative, but yeah. People did not. I mean, the protests were really that they got so big that they lasted so long. Mm-hmm. That was a surprise.
Yeah. Well, the other question, I suppose, is the protests were organized largely over social media, and so far, Armenia hasn't gone down the path of Russia or China, for that matter, in terms of really trying to crack down on and regulate social media. It'll be interesting, depending how this crisis plays out, I suppose, whether that is something that the new government is going to look into.
Well, we'll be watching from here.
Yeah.
So that's it for our show today. We've got a link to Leonid's publications and magazine in the show notes, and also to our discussion of Armenia from a few weeks ago.
And once again, a reminder to those of you who haven't, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where you can also leave us a rating or a review. And for those of you who are not iTunes users, you can check us out and subscribe on either Google Play or SoundCloud.
Finally, one more reminder to send in your mailbag questions to rep@csis.org. Put the words Russian roulette in the subject line. We look forward to hearing from you. We did a mailbag just recently, but we promise to do them more frequently going forward.
Assuming you send us mail.
Right. If we have no mail, there will be no mailbag feature.
You can follow us on Twitter at CSIS Russia, and you can follow us individually as well at Olya Oliker and at Dr. J. Mankoff.
Finally, a big thanks to everybody who works so hard to make this podcast happen every other week. That's our research assistant and program coordinator, Cyrus Newlin, our intern, Claire Hafner, and the entire CSIS External Relations and iLab team.
And thank you, as always, for listening, and we will be with you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.